Claire. Down, like.
Today is Friday, Monday, February 6th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. It's nothing more.
Good evening. It's 5:05 p.m. and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Vancouver and Lower Mainland, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this, plus an interview with UBC Outreach Coordinator Ted Wilson, and your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your local and provincial headlines.
A new temporary day shelter reserved for women opened its doors today in the downtown east side. The shelter is developed by the Union Gospel Mission with the help of the Downtown Eastside Women's Center, or the DEWC, and will be open weekdays from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. for 12 single women and women with children. Union Gospel Mission spokesperson Keela Keeping said the three-month pilot project aims to help keep the women off the street during the day. At night, these women are able to stay in the DEWC shelter 412, nearby emergency night shelter for women. The mission will also provide support services and follow-up services. Keeping said, quote, "Being able to give these women the rest, safety, meals, and the tangible help that they need is going to be our big goal," end quote. Adding that the UGM Center is also transitioning from a drop-in model to a wraparound model. Keeping said that if the shelter is successful and funding can be raised, UGM plans to keep the day shelter open year-round.
Last week, we had reported on how the Vancouver police turned to the public through the media for their help in solving the cases of Vancouver's five remaining missing persons from 2011. It turns out that this plea worked for one of those cases, which has now been solved. Daniel Holt, age 29, was found living in another community outside of Metro Vancouver, police said on Monday. He was using a different name. The police's missing persons unit confirmed that a television viewer recognized the photograph of Daniel Holt and called their local police. The police contacted Holt, who confirmed his identity. Holt had worked for a software company in Victoria in the past and had spent time living on a boat moored in North Vancouver, which was from where he was reported missing by his mother on September 12, 2011.
In a recent press event at City Hall, Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson announced his support for increasing fairness and citizen involvement in municipal elections in hopes of improving the democratic process at a local level. Mayor Robertson said, quote, "The current rules are out of date with the types of elections being run in Vancouver and across BC. It's time the province took major steps to increase the fairness and transparency of local elections," end quote. Mayor Robertson was recently re-elected as mayor of Vancouver in the November civic elections. The introduction of a new legislation for the Provincial Minister of Community, Sport and Cultural Development is being requested by City Councillor Andrea Reimer in the hopes of updating the Vancouver Charter. Reimer plans to ask for the additional inclusion of setting limits on annual contribution amounts to individual candidates and elector organizers, banning union and corporate donations, annual spending limits by candidates and elector organizations, and continuous disclosure of donations and expenses.
In more mayoral news today, Mayor Gregor Robertson has announced the members of the Mayor's Task Force on Housing Affordability, which will be co-chaired by him and Olga Illich, a developer and former BC Liberal cabinet member. Robertson announced the task force in his inaugural speech on December 5th after being re-elected in the November civic election. The goal of this housing task force is to identify ways the City of Vancouver can better protect the affordable housing that exists and how to create new affordable housing. The task force is expected to deliver its interim report by March 12th. After public input on the interim report is sought between March and May, the final report should be completed by June 30th.
More than 600 protesters took to the streets of Prince Rupert, BC, over the weekend to oppose Enbridge's proposed Northern Gateway pipeline from Alberta's oil sands to Kitimat, a port on the northern BC coast. The large rally is being hosted by the Hartley Bay First Nation, a tiny village at the end of the Douglas Channel, which would be the main access point for tankers arriving at the proposed Enbridge terminal in Kitimat. Bob Hill, treaty coordinator and negotiator for the GITGAT and an MC for the rally, said the event was planned in the lead-up to the National Energy Board hearings slated to visit the area later this month. A federal review panel is meeting in communities affected by the proposed pipeline, and more than 4,300 speakers have signed up for the process, which could last into next year. The panel meets in Prince Rupert beginning February 16th for a week. Opponents argue the potential for a catastrophic oil spill is too great a risk for the controversial project, while supporters say the pipeline could boost the country's GDP by as much as $270 billion.
Racist groups in BC are part of an international network exposed by recent anti-Nazi document leaks, linking prominent hate groups' online activities with the suspects of a string of violent attacks on people of different races in Vancouver. Human rights and anti-racist activists are praising Anonymous, saying its recent release of troves of data on neo-Nazi and other hate groups has likely undermined their increased activity in British Columbia. The hacking attacks come amid rumors that white supremacists from the group Blood and Honor are rumored to be planning a rally in Vancouver to mark March 21st, International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, claiming that white people are now the victims of, quote, reverse racism, end quote. Similar racist March 21 protests in Calgary, Alberta, over the past several years have led to counter-protests by anti-racist groups.
And those are your local and provincial headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Norman Otis Richmond, a Toronto-based journalist, is one of the main advocates in Canada for the renaming of Black History Month as African Liberation Month. He is a longtime producer and host of the radio programs Saturday Morning Live, Diasporic Music, and From a Different Perspective. His words have been heard through the studios of CIUT, CHIN, CFNY, CBC, and CKLN, and read on countless newspapers and blogs. In 1992, Otis was the recipient of the Toronto Arts Award and dedicated it to Mumia Abu-Jamal, Assata Shakur, and Geronimo Pratt, the African National Congress of South Africa, Fidel Castro, and the people of Cuba.
This PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM.
And welcome back to CITR News 101. You're listening to us on the radio at 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. We now are joined by Ted Wilson, the co-coordinator for UBC's Out Week 2012, in the studio right now. So, Ted, it's great to have you with us here today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, no problem. So this must be a very exciting week for you. I think the week has just started out, right? So has it been busy planning and you have a lot of events planned? Or?
Oh, yeah. We have, it's a week and a half, actually, of what we're doing. Because 1 week really wasn't enough at this point. So we have, up until the 15th, we have basically at least two events every day happening during the school day and after school to try to accommodate to different people's needs.
And are these events, are they geared primarily towards UBC students, or are they something that's really open to the community? I mean, who's your target here?
We want to go out to the community as a whole, but part of Outweek is raising awareness on the UBC campus. Mm-hmm. So we do wish that students will participate, as well as people outside of school as well.
So for you personally, I guess, how have you found working with Outweek? Is this your first time working on Outweek?
Yes.
Yeah. So how has it been? Is it bigger than you expected or easier?
Oh, it's massive. I mean, we're emailing people on a constant basis, just trying to get everyone to say, okay, yeah, we can help you with this event or things like that. Just the queer community is massive in Vancouver, and I hadn't really realized that until we started branching out to every possible venue that we could access. So,
right. So you said that 1 week is enough. So is there an Outweek in the first half of the first semester as well? Then
no, that just means that we have a week and a half.
Right. Okay. Perfect.
Right now. So.
And is it coinciding with any other Outweeks, I guess, in the province or the area, or is it?
No, not at the moment. This is just what Pride UBC is doing, but we're working with the grad students as well for
okay.
the second week.
So, what are some of the events that you're going to be running this week?
Well, just in a short while, we're going to have X Queries, which anyone can come to, but it'll be five of our private exec members will be talking about their lifestyles, which ranges from transgendered lifestyles, polyamorous, lesbian and gay. And you can ask basically anything, and we mean anything. So that'll be happening at 6 to 8 Buchanan D 229, I believe. It'll be going on for 2 hours, so people can go over to that. Tomorrow we have a bondage workshop with Trans Tea Time after that, and that'll be from 1 to 2 in the sub. And also on Tuesday we have an event at the Boulevard where artists can come, just visual artists, but musicians and slam poets and things like that. Mm-hmm. They can come to the Boulevard and sort of talk with each other, share their pieces, maybe perform if they'd like. So that'd be really exciting. I'd be excited to see all sorts of queer artists come to that one.
And yeah, that sounds great. I mean, it really sounds like you're trying to reach out to a diverse community with events like that, not necessarily just the queer community, but I guess UBC as a whole.
Yeah.
And I guess from that, like, what have you found the response to Outweek to be in terms of, I guess, just like what sort of attendance you expect and the response from students in terms of engagement?
Well, it hasn't been a negative response so far, which is always a good thing. But things are looking pretty good. I mean, our biggest event, I think, will be the queer prom that's happening on Friday, which we believe about 60 people will be there for when there's a meal, but we're expecting about 100 people to show up overall. So that'll be exciting.
Wow. No, it definitely sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, I guess, could you just let our listeners know a bit about what do you think the significance is of Outweek, I guess, both for UBC and, I guess, the Vancouver community?
Well, I think part of it is just making people aware that there is a queer community on UBC and that there are still queer issues that need to happen. Part of the theme of this week is Make It Better, which is a response to Dan Savage's It Gets Better.
Right.
Which sort of makes people realize, we're trying to make people realize that just because queer people are accepted in some places, like there's gay marriage rights up in Canada and some of the states, doesn't mean that everything is solved and that people who are in less privileged positions need help. We're also celebrating, you know, getting this far and what we have done so far, but we also want to make people aware that we need to keep working.
I think that's definitely really interesting because I know Dan Savage was, I think, at first very much praised for his It Gets Better campaign, but I guess now it seems more, I guess, like a passive stance almost, like waiting for it to get better, whereas I guess saying Make It Better, it's much more active and saying, like, let's go out there as a community, let's, like, improve it, and let's do what we can to, like, make it better for everyone.
Yeah, so and the queer lifestyle is very subjective, so having a lot of white people talk about their privileged, you know, experiences is kind of problematic, so...
In terms of that, I mean, what do you see the role of Outweek and Pride UBC as a whole being, I guess, in the global community? Whereas, as you said, a lot of people, they can't be as open about their sexuality. There are a lot more restrictions, and in terms of just, like, acceptance, they have a lot more restrictions on that. So what do you see the role of Outweek and Pride UBC being in helping people in those situations?
Well, we can't do much to reach out to those people from what we have here, but what we can do is spur on a community that is more conscious of what they're doing with the queer community and possibly have them branch out as they possibly graduate or maybe study abroad or something like that, and just so that they leave with a state of mind that they're more aware of the yeah. queer issues that yes. are going on.
Global ambassadors, almost, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. yeah.
Perfect. Well, I guess just to wrap it up, I mean, if there is one or two key events that even people in our news team should attend, what would you say they should be?
Well, on our very last day, on the 15th, we have Queer You, which will be a bunch of panels and workshops, which will end with a wine and cheese event at the very end. And the wine and cheese is free.
Oh,
so good incentive to go.
You convinced us.
Yeah. Really.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for coming in, Ted. It's great to talk to you, and best of luck with this week, and I hope you've got great attendance and great time for everyone.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Right, thank you. So once again, that was Ted Wilson, the co-coordinator of Outweek for UBC, and Outweek is running from today until the 15th, is it?
That's right.
February 15th. So yeah, thanks, Ted, for joining us in studio.
Thank you.
And you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us.
Right now, I really need a break.
Do you ever wonder if traveling can actually enhance your education?
Yeah, how?
Easy. With the Study and Go Abroad Fair, you can find information on semesters or degree programs abroad, working, volunteering, and even adventure travel.
Just what I need, when and where.
March 1st at the Vancouver Convention Center. Doors are at 1, but guest speakers start at noon. Admission is free, and you'll be entered to win a trip to Guatemala, Peru, or even an iPad.
What's the website?
Go to studyandgoabroad.com for more information and to pre-register.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And welcome back to CITR News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. I'm Claire Eagle, and now it is time for our local weather forecast for the week, brought to you by Phil from the UBC Storm Club. So take it away, Phil.
Thank you, Claire, and good evening, listeners. Did you enjoy that fabulous weather today? Well, better enjoy it while it lasts.
No.
The rest of the week looks like a deluge of rain every day, due to a huge swarm front about to hit us in the next few days. On the bright side, with two or three low pressure systems coming our way, the fog we've been seeing in Richmond and surrounding areas will cease to make an appearance. Now, here is your 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, no clouds with a low of 0. Tuesday, sunny, high of 8. Wednesday, cloudy with a chance of showers, high of 7, low of 4. Thursday, rain, high of 10, low of 8. Friday, more rain, high of 8, low of 8. So that's your 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is 7 degrees Celsius here on campus. I'm with CJ, Claire, and Iqbal in the sub. For News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Great. Thanks, as always, Phil, for that great weather forecast. So we're just going to take a very quick break right now, but do stay with us. We'll be right back with your national headlines. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
The 12th season of the Vancouver International Dance Festival explores the polarities of ballet and buto, and features artists from Japan, Montreal, San Francisco, and Vancouver. The festival runs from March 2nd through 11th. For tickets or more information, check out vidf.ca or call the box office at 604-662-4966.
Liveband.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the city's most active promoters, musicians, and by the driving force of the music scene, the fans. LiveBand.com's listings are different because they are integrated with profiles updated by bands and business owners as they promote upcoming events. Check out the archives to see how closely we've worked within the community to put on the shows you love. Visit LiveMusicVancouver.com for the latest independent and major label event listings. LiveBand.com, Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us. It's now time for your national news.
A Conservative MP has filed a motion in the House of Commons asking Parliament to form a special committee to study the legal definition of a human being. This stands to bring the hotly contested abortion issue back to the forefront of Canadian politics, a move that Prime Minister Harper has repeatedly stated he has no intention of making. Stephen Woodworth, the MP for Kitchener Centre in Ontario, stated that his goal is to have a, quote, respectful dialogue to update a 400-year definition of a human being, end quote. MP Woodworth would not comment to reporters on whether his intention was to reopen the national debate on abortion. He stated that the current Canadian legal definition, which defines a human being after they are born, has its roots in British legal treatises written in the 17th century. Justice Minister Rob Nicholson swiftly issued a statement Monday reiterating Prime Minister Stephen Harper's firm stance on the issue. "The Prime Minister has been very clear, our government will not reopen this debate," Nicholson said. On his reason for bringing up the issue, despite the Prime Minister's opposition to discussing Canada's abortion laws, Woodworth said it's a matter he, quote, feels strongly about, and relates to his, quote, professional responsibility. According to the motion, Woodworth is suggesting that 12 MPs, so 7 Conservative, 4 NDP, and 1 Liberal MP, join the committee to be chaired by a Conservative MP with possible substitutions. Canada has not had legal restrictions on abortion since 1988.
The official opposition wants Canada's ambassador recalled from Syria, but the government says he will stay in the besieged country to blast President Bashar Assad for his attacks on domestic dissenters. This pressure comes after the United States chose to withdraw its ambassador from the intensifying violence in Syria. Quote, "The U.S. is, as a sovereign nation, makes decisions based on its situation," end quote, wrote a spokesperson for Foreign Minister John Baird in an email to the National Post. Quote, "We make decisions based on ours," end quote, Roth said, Canada's ambassador to Syria. Retired Vice Admiral Glenn Davidson will remain in Damascus to voice Canada's displeasure at the ongoing government crackdown in the country. However, the staff has been cut down to a minimal number in order to ensure staff safety. The diplomatic moves follow a veto by Russia and China that killed a UN Security Council resolution condemning the Assad regime. NDP Foreign Affairs critic Helen Laverdiere urged the government to recall the envoy because she said it would send a strong message to Mr. Assad, who has waged a bloody 11-month crackdown on dissent in his country that has left thousands dead.
And those were your national headlines. It is now time for your international news. We start off our global headlines with a very interesting and informative interview that Russia Today had with Mehdi Hassan, senior political editor of New Statesman magazine. Mr. Hassan discusses the ongoing civil war in Syria and explains the complex relationship between Israel, U.S., and Iran.
It's a very interesting interview because I was listening to it yesterday, and Mr. Hassan was talking to the reporter a lot about how the complexity between each of those countries in the Middle East, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's especially pertinent now because we've been seeing especially there's a lot of insinuations that there is like increasing conflict between the three, of course. So with no further ado, we'll go to that interview from Russia Today.
Hassan, who's the senior political editor for the New Statesman magazine, we're going to be talking about the violence that's going on in Syria at the moment and also the developing situation in Iran. Mehdi Hassan, thank you very much for talking to me today. Now, we've seen observers being sent into Syria who seem to have done nothing to stop the violence. In fact, the death toll has risen from 20 to 30 people a day. How good do you think the observers are at implementing their mandate?
I do think they're very good, given how one of the leaders of the mission when it originally went in was a Sudanese general general who's been accused of carrying out war crimes and ethnic cleansing in Darfur, which slightly hobbled both the legitimacy of the mission and the trust that a lot of Syrian opposition groups had in the Arab League mission. Since then, the Saudi Arabians have complained about the mission. They've pulled out their observer, they're pulling out their ambassador. I mean, the Arab League has really been all over the place on Syria. On the one hand, it's condemned Syria. It was praised for the first time condemning a fellow Arab nation and putting a resolution in a few months ago. Since then, its own mission has been criticised for, among other things, the personnel it's deployed and its inability to stop the violence. I think the real issue is that the Syrians need to allow in a much more neutral, a much more wide-ranging, a much more forceful international observer mission. If they've got nothing to hide, if they're genuinely not killing innocent people, then what have they got to hide?
And what about sanctions? The UK recently proposed tougher sanctions on Syria, things like travel bans, asset freezes. What effect, if any, do you think they'll have?
It depends how targeted the sanctions are. I'm always on the fence over sanctions, given the experience we had with Iraq for over a decade of sanctions, which caused more suffering to the people than to the Saddam regime. I support sanctions if they're targeted against regime members, if they're targeted against people who are indicted for human rights violations or war crimes, fine. If they squeeze the country itself and the people who've done nothing wrong, then I think that's a mistake. I think we have to think much more creatively about Syria. I'm not one of those who supports military action. Syria isn't Libya. It won't be easy. It won't be legitimate without a UN resolution. And more innocent people will die than have already died. But that doesn't mean you just turn a blind eye to the violence that's going on. More than 5,000 people have died, according to the UN's own figures. And Assad is a man who clearly is not backing down. You look at some of his interviews, you know, he's not as bonkers as Colonel Gaddafi, but he says some pretty crazy things about how it's nothing to do with me, not my orders, these are all armed rebels, everyone who's dying.
And let's talk about the opposition for a little bit. There appear to be three sort of distinct blocks. There's the Free Syrian Army, there's a kind of external opposition, there's people in the street. Do you think they'll be able to form any kind of cohesive group?
Well, that's one of the objections that a lot of people are having against any kind of external military action, which is, where is the legitimacy? In Libya, you had a opposition movement which, despite being consisting of different groups, secular, religious, etc., indigenous, and those outside the country, they did form a united opposition for the purposes of getting rid of Gaddafi, and they controlled territory. Benghazi, it's what prompted the intervention to begin with. In Syria, they don't control any territory, they don't control any cities or towns, and there is this division between the external opposition figures, like the leader of the Syrian National Council, who's based in Paris, and those who are on the streets, who have said again and again to Western reporters, to human rights groups, that we don't want military intervention. We're opposed to both the Syrian president, we're opposed to the Assad regime, and we're opposed to Western intervention. We saw what happened in Iraq. I mean, the Syrians, what's interesting about the Syrians is that they saw up close and personal the effects of Western intervention in Iraq, because hundreds of thousands of Iraqi refugees fled into Syria. They know the consequences of a kind of ill-timed, ill-thought-out, heavy-handed Western intervention, which just exacerbates the violence.
And the Free Syrian Army, as far as you can see, what are they fighting for? Does it look like genuine democracy?
There's a huge debate about the FSA and how much, first of all, how many defections that are going on, because they claim to be getting dozens and dozens of defectors every day, every week, from Assad's Syrian armed forces. And yet others, independent observers, not just the Assad regime and its apologists, are saying, well, actually, it's a trickle. And they're exaggerating their own strength in order to, again, justify Western intervention. If you look at the history of Western interventions, so-called humanitarian interventions, you always see there's an equivalent of the FSA on the ground, whether in Libya or if you go back to Kosovo and the KLA, which also said, you know, give us the guns, give us the air support and we'll do the fighting. And in Afghanistan, you had the Northern Alliance. And actually, it turns out that these groups tend, A, not to have as much legitimacy as they claim, and B, not to have as much military strength as they claim.
And the Free Syrian Army is accused of killing people itself, isn't it? Do we have any idea of sort of the number of those casualties?
Well, again, without wanting to overdo the comparison between Libya and Syria, one of the things you see is when you do support rebel groups, sometimes unsavoury groups, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend, you support people who are perhaps not the greatest defenders or advocates of human rights themselves. In Afghanistan, we supported all sorts of unsavoury warlords and still do. In Libya, the opposition groups, the National Transition Council there in Libya, was accused by Human Rights Watch during the conflict of carrying out all sorts of killings and abuses of prisoners, which still haven't been resolved or properly accounted for. Do we then want to lurch into a Syrian conflict where, again, we are ignorant of what's going on the ground? We're not experts on who these people are, what these groups stand for. And the FSA, of course, if you consist of defecting soldiers from an army that's carried out human rights abuses, then a lot of those defectors would have been part of those human rights abuses. That's just a horrible reality of the world we live in.
And in terms of the actual people, do you see a link between the Libyan Islamists and those on the ground in Syria?
Well, there've been reports, and as you know, as with all these conflicts, you know, they're grey and and they're murky, that Libyan Islamist groups fighting in Libya, finished fighting in Libya, have transferred over to help some of the Syrian opposition groups.
And do you see an inexorable move towards intervention?
Since the new year, my position is changing, and I can imagine a scenario where we are, where NATO is asked, or the British government or the American government is asked to enforce a no-fly zone, to enforce some kind of safety corridor. Look, which would be with the ostensible aim of protecting human rights, all well and good, but would push us into all sorts of areas of the Middle East we don't want to be involved in, because Syria, for example, is a much bigger player in the Israel-Arab conflict. It's a much bigger country and tougher to overcome and beat militarily. If it took us that long to beat Libya, how long do you think it'll take us to beat Syria?
How far do you think Syria is already essentially a battlefield between Iran and the West?
The Israelis have been clear for many years that if you can pull Syria out of Iran's orbit, you will weaken Iran, which they consider to be the number one enemy, the number one menace in the neighbourhood, the number one threat to Israel's strategic interests. So if you can get Syria away from Iran, either through a diplomatic deal, which they tried for many years, or through regime change, which seems to be the direction of travel now, then it will definitely weaken Iran. And all roads in the Middle East right now do seem to lead back to Tehran.
And Saudi Arabia's relationship with Iran is increasingly hostile. It accuses Iran of supporting this protesting Shiite minority. How do you think that could play out?
Saudi Arabia's own position is brazenly one-sided, brazenly self-serving and hypocritical. Here you have Saudi Arabia having pulled its ambassador out of Damascus, having complained about the Arab League on the ground and its human rights observations. Well, first of all, the Saudi Arabians have their own human rights abuses to deal with at home, their own oppressive regime. But even if you take the Arab Spring, the Saudis have thrown their weight behind the Syrian opposition to Assad, and yet have done their utmost best to stop the Arab Spring, to stop the revolts in all of the other countries, in Egypt, in Bahrain, where Saudi troops went into Bahrain, are still in Bahrain, suppressing protests in Bahrain, and yet in Syria they're supporting the opposition. If that's not one-sidedness, I don't know what is, and that shows you that Saudi Arabia's own interests have nothing to do with human rights or democracy. Of course not. How could Saudi Arabia be interested in such issues? It's about trying to deal with Iran, and we know from WikiLeaks that the Saudi king told the American government, cut the head off the snake, i.e. deal with the snake that is Iran, in his view.
And Iran has been threatening recently to block the Strait of Hormuz, which of course we know is the main export route for Gulf oil. What do you think the political consequences of that could be?
I'm deeply and genuinely worried about what will happen if the Iranians shut the Strait of Hormuz as they promised. I think you'll have a situation where we start sleepwalking into war on both sides, where there are extremists on both sides who want a conflict, who would love a conflict because it would serve their purposes in the West. There are people who want to take out Iran, both for America's national interest, so-called, and of course for the Israelis. And in Iran, there are hardliners who see that the Islamic Revolution is failing, who are seeing the Green Movement popular, who are seeing lots of people protesting against the regime, and see a foreign war, who see the idea of being under attack as a way of uniting the country. So there are hardliners on both sides, and I think the people in the middle have to be careful that we don't allow the hardliners to kind of allow us to sleepwalk into war, where they shut the Straits of Hormuz, and the Americans, who I suspect don't want to go to war, not in an election year, are forced to come in order to secure the oil and to protect the Israelis if Israel were to attack Iran as well, which is a $64,000 question.
You've mentioned that this year is, of course, an election year in the US. Do you think that the US is likely to wait until that election is over, when in doing so it could anger Israel by not acting sooner?
Well, that's the interesting question. I think of their own free will, I don't think they do want to go to war. I think Obama is running on a campaign of trying to energise his base, saying, we're the guys who ended Iraq, we're the guys who are going to bring troops home from Afghanistan, we're the guys who took a back seat in Libya and didn't put boots on the ground. The idea that you would then kick off a conflict with Iran, and as one American general put it, you know, if you liked Iraq and Afghanistan, you'll love Iran. I mean, it would be a major conflict. And I think if you listen to, for example, Defence Secretary Panetta saying recently that actually an attack on Iran would have unintended consequences, would be a backlash against American troops in the region. Clearly, he's not keen on it. And yet, if the Israelis were to strike Iran and Iran were to strike back, then the Americans would be drawn in whether they like it or not, because they can't abandon Israel. They can't abandon Israel for strategic purposes. They certainly can't abandon Israel in election year.
We're in very shaky economic times globally at the moment, but what no one seems to be talking about is what the economic consequences of a war with Iran would be.
In an age where we are facing a double-dip recession, possibly another Great Depression, where oil prices are already so high, we could see an attack on Iran pushing oil prices above $150 a barrel. Some analysts say even a record high of above $200 a barrel, which really would tip the entire world economy, not just us, but the Asians, the Chinese, back into a major, major recession, major downturn. And I think people have kind of turned a blind eye to this. And only recently, with the Iranians threatening to block the Strait of Hormuz, where I think a third of the world's seaborne oil passes through, have people started to go, well, wait a minute, what the hell is going to happen to oil prices? And I think that's a factor in the American government's reasoning as well, perhaps less so in the Israeli government's reasoning.
Mehdi Hassan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to Russia Today for that interview with Mehdi Hassan, the senior political editor of the New Statesman magazine. On a similar note on Syria, Al Jazeera's Tony Harris speaks to Danny Abdul Dayem, an activist and citizen journalist from the city of Homs in Syria, who has been recording and reporting on how the Syrian armed forces have been randomly bombing the city of Homs, resulting in massive civilian casualties.
Danny Abdul Dayem is an activist. He is joining us now on Skype from the city of Homs. Danny, good to speak with you again. Obviously, more violence. We just saw some of the pictures from the Bab Amr neighborhood of Homs, where you are. We're going to roll some of the video that you've sent to us. Talk to us about the violence today and the video that we're about to see that you actually shot and were involved in.
All right, it's been terrible today. From about 8 a.m., non-stop bombarding this area with rockets and mortar bombs and tank shells. The video I think you've got on is me. It's an old man who got hit by a mortar bomb, by the fragments of a mortar bomb. One of 50. There's more than 50 injured in Bab Amr today. I saw with my own eyes kids with no legs. A kid, he lost his whole jaw in the bottom. It's terrible. A small little girl, she's 4 years old, she was dead. And these are all civilians. They're living in their houses. See, even in their houses, they're not safe. This is all after what the United Nations had yesterday. Thus, the United Nations gave our Syrian government the green light to kill more.
And Danny, if you would,
they gave the government the green light.
Yeah, if you would describe the next piece of video we're going to roll here of some of the shelling in the city as well. And I understand at one point you were actually in a building that was shelled. If you would describe that for us.
Yes. All right, I got in a building. It was shelled. I was in the second floor. I think that was the kitchen and the living room. They shelled it. That was a rocket. That was not a mortar bomb. That was a rocket that hit it. And while I was going down the stairs, I was still videoing. Another rocket hit you can hear it in the end. A rocket hit the building again. They did not stop bombarding. Every 30 seconds, a bomb would land. A rocket would land somewhere in Bab Amr. And Bab Amr has a population of 28,000 people. They are randomly bombarding everyone, women, children, kids, men. You should hear the screaming. The UN just left the Syrian people to die. They left them. The Syrian people have no one now. We did not want the Arab League. We wanted the UN to help us, and it left us alone. The Russian government has blood on the Syrian blood is on their hands. The Chinese government has Syrian blood on their hands. They're helping our government kill and rape women and rape children every day.
So, Danny, let me take a moment here to do a bit of a deeper dive on this situation in Bab Amr and a couple of the other neighborhoods and Homs with you. So, I'm wondering if the Free Syrian Army has a presence in the Bab Amr neighborhood that you're in now. Is the Free Syrian Army there?
Yes. Yes, it is. But the Free Syrian Army has Kalashnikovs, has machine guns, has some RBJ rockets. The Syrian Army is not attacking with troops, is not coming in. Even if they did come in, they would come in with tanks and BMBs. What could machine guns do against these? They did not come in. They've been shelling us. I've been telling you, they've been shelling us for a whole week now with bombs, rockets, and tank shells. What could the Free Syrian Army do about that?
Okay, so
the Free Syrian Army is in Bab Amr, but it's only defending. It's not attacking. It defends. Anyone who attacks it, it defends it.
So let me ask you this. Is there any sense of growing civilian resentment to the presence of the Free Syrian Army in these neighborhoods? The idea being that the presence of the Free Syrian Army is bringing on this this attack, this retaliation, this fighting from the Syrian army?
That is so false. The people want the Free Syrian Army. The people want the Free Syrian Army to stay here. They welcome them then. The Syrian Army is living in the people's house. The people want them here to protect them. If it wasn't for the Syrian Army, the mercenaries, the Syrian Army would be in Bab Amr now, raping the women, killing the men, stabbing children. You saw what happened a week ago in Kerem Zeytun and 2 days ago in Khaldi. They bombed Khaldi because about 70 from the Free Syrian Army defected, and they went to Khaldi, and the people and the civilians went down to welcome the Free Syrian Army. That was about 3 days ago, and the Syrian Army bombarded Khaldi for more than 4 hours.
Okay, Danny, one last question.
The civilians here want the Free Syrian Army.
Okay, one final question for you. I'm curious, with all of the fighting that's going on, can you describe for us what daily life is like for people there? Are shops open? Can you buy food? Is there any commerce going on at all?
You could find some shops open if you're lucky. Shops shut for about 4 p.m. Every shop shuts. Restaurants shut 4 p.m. if you want to cut a street, if you want to go across another street, you have to run. You can't walk, because a sniper will shoot you. We've got snipers all around Bab Amr on all the tall buildings. They'll shoot at anyone, women, men, kids. So it's running. 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock, everyone's in the house. No one leaves their house. That's how people are living here.
Danny, I appreciate your time. Danny Abdul Dayem is an activist. He's on Skype with us from Homs. Danny, good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Thank you to Al Jazeera for that. We now go to Al Jazeera again for news on how loyalists of Libya's ousted leader Muammar Gaddafi have seized control of the town of Bani Walid.
It's a show of force, but the reality is that the fighters for the National Transitional Council are no longer in control of Bani Walid.
The city of Bani Walid has not been liberated yet. Gaddafi's militias, together with Dorman cells, are still operating inside. We contacted many concerned bodies, including the Defense Ministry, more than 2 months ago.
He says they never received any help and were ambushed on Monday afternoon in a battle that lasted 7 hours. Now, all the NTC fighters who had control of the city have retreated to the outskirts and are manning checkpoints.
This is one of the main access points into Bani Walid. Now, what happened is that this city was one of the last of Gaddafi's strongholds to fall during the war. When the rebels moved in, they ransacked many of the houses, stealing a lot of people's belongings. So when the people came back, they didn't have anything left. So there's a lot of anger here at the government because they feel that they haven't been compensated for what they lost.
But the pro-government fighters here are adamant they want to take the city back. And they say brigades are coming to help them from all across Libya.
They are coming, we've been in touch with them. Some of them coming from the west, from Benghazi and all the towns. And some of them, they're already there. They surrounded the town from the other two sides. Misrata surrounded the side from the end of the town as well. And we are from here, and we're waiting for just for the green light.
And that go-ahead has to come from the government. No one wants to go in without the official orders from above. The feeling here is that the fighters are capable of taking Bani Walid back by force, and there is a strong desire to do that. But the government would rather see a negotiated end to the standoff. Another bloody battle in one of Libya's cities is the last thing it wants. It really would have to be a last resort. Stephanie Decker, Al Jazeera, on the outskirts of Bani Walid.
Thank you to Al Jazeera for that video, or a clip, I should say. Up next, Gabriel Elizondo, a reporter for Al Jazeera, reports on the violent crime in one of Brazil's biggest cities, El Salvador, and how it is soaring as state police strike over pay.
Tired and hungry, these Malian families have made the long journey across the border into Mauritania. In the last few days, the numbers escaping the growing unrest has risen to more than 1,500 a day.
For the time being, what we are doing is trying to attend to their initial needs and ensuring that...
The National Police Force stands guard out front of the airport, a sure sign something isn't right in Salvador. Everywhere in the city, small teams of soldiers patrol the streets, part of a 3,000 force contingent the federal government has sent in. One third of the police force in Bahia State is on strike, and the criminals are now wreaking havoc in the streets. More than 30 murders were committed in less than a 24-hour period this weekend. Residents are terrified. The state capital was on the verge of paralysis. Brazil's Minister of Justice arrived in Salvador this weekend with a clear message, pointing the finger of blame for the violence at the police on strike.
The federal government is here to offer our full support. And I tell you, Governor, you have our unconditional support so that you can fulfill your mission of defense of law and order.
A judge has ruled the strike is illegal. 12 arrest warrants for union leaders have been issued, but police are defiant. Dozens of officers occupied the legislative assembly, chanting, "The police have stopped," a clear affront to the government.
These police officers that are on strike are trying to send a big message to the government that they feel they deserve higher wages. And one of their protest measures is to puncture the tires on some of these police cars. It's their way of saying they're not working until their demands are met.
They also rejected government accusations that they are fueling the crime wave.
I'm not a criminal, I'm a police officer, a father with two children and a wife. If the governor wants to resolve things like that, my imprisonment, I tell you, will cause chaos in the city, the likes of which have never been seen.
Nobody seems willing to back down.
I have no doubt that police want better work conditions, but they cannot promote breaking the law and allow people to threaten the population with guns and take public property.
For now, it seems as though the soldiers will stay on the streets indefinitely, at least until this deadlock is resolved. Gabriel Elizondo, Al Jazeera, Salvador, Brazil.
Thank you to Gabriel Elizondo, a correspondent for Al Jazeera in El Salvador. Aid groups say that more than 15,000 people have fled Mali as fighting escalates in the West African country. A correspondent for Al Jazeera reports on this.
Tired and hungry, these Malian families have made the long journey across the border into Mauritania. In the last few days, the numbers escaping the growing unrest has risen to more than 1,500 a day.
For the time being, what we are doing is trying to attend to their initial needs and ensuring that they're well safe and they have essential water and food rations available where they are today in Mauritania.
After years of relative peace, a band of Tuareg fighters are leading a new rebellion against the government in Mali. They're demanding independence for the northern Azawad region. It's believed the leaders have returned home from Libya, where they were soldiers in Muammar Gaddafi's army. Since the fall of his regime, many have returned home unemployed and poor. They're now rekindling their demands for autonomy.
They have a lot of weapons right now that they've brought back with them from Libya. They have tremendous amounts of military experience. They've fought a lot of wars for Gaddafi, and they've fought in his military. So they're coming back. They feel this is the right time for them to ask for something that they've been asking for a long time.
Many Malians are angry about the renewed rebellion.
We are afraid of being killed. We don't want to move because we might be killed. That's why we are stuck here.
The government in Mali has asked people not to blame all Tuaregs for the actions of a single rebel group. But people are growing fearful of potential revenge attacks. Thousands of kilometers away from the Libyan battleground, the fall of the Gaddafi regime is still opening up old wounds. Nazanin Sadri, Al Jazeera.
Thank you to Al Jazeera for that. We now go to FSRN for information on the deadly strikes in Syria and how they've increased after the failure of the UN resolution this past weekend.
Today in Syria, attacks and shelling continued in cities throughout the country. Homs, long a center of the resistance to the regime of Bashar al-Assad, received the brunt of bombardment. A video posted on YouTube appears to show residential buildings of homes with the sound of rockets falling nearby. Other videos showed smoke rising along the skyline with the whine of shots in the distance. Residents told local media that they were starting to collect medicine, food, and water, and described the city surrounded by armed forces. According to activists with the local coordination committees, more than 200 people were killed on Saturday, including 181 in homes. The group reported dozens more today. The violence of the past few days is one of the deadliest periods of the nearly 11-month-long crackdown on dissent. The strikes intensified as international diplomacy efforts to bring an end to the violence in Syria failed at the United Nations over the weekend. On Saturday, China and Russia voted down a UN Security Council resolution that would have called for a transition to a democratic, pluralistic political system and an end to attacks on civilians. After the vote, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called the veto a travesty and warned of a rise in violence. UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon expressed deep regret, and U.S. Ambassador to the UN Susan Rice said pressure on the Assad regime would continue.
This council today again had a sad moment which will be recorded in its history. But there was a hopeful aspect to it as well, and that is that more and more countries are united in saying the violence must stop, change must come, there must be a democratic and peaceful transition.
Russia's representative to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, defended the veto. Russia has said it does not want to intervene in what it calls a domestic matter. Churkin said the Security Council should not be pressured to adopt a plan modeled on the Arab League, a regional group.
There is no rule that the Security Council should repeat all resolutions adopted by regional organizations verbatim. They are not Quran or Bible. I mean, we can express our views on the texts which were adopted months ago, even if we are trying to facilitate, promote, and help the work of those regional organizations.
Today, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said diplomacy would still be a priority, but did not completely rule out military intervention at some point.
The right solution in Syria is a political solution, and there remains an opportunity for that to be achieved, for that transition to democracy to take place. That's why we felt and we continue to feel it's so important for the international community to act in the way that a Security Council resolution would have embodied. And we'll continue to work with our international partners in this regard, because the best solution here is a political solution. Broadly speaking, we take no options off the table, but our focus is on using our diplomatic, economic, and other means to help bring about and usher in a democratic transition.
Carney said the U.S. would continue to work with partners in the region, but warned that time was running out.
We need to act to allow a peaceful political transition to go forward before the regime's escalating violence puts a political solution out of reach.
Today, the U.S. State Department suspended all embassy operations in Syria, citing bombings in December and January and the deteriorating security situation. In a statement, the State Department said Ambassador Robert Ford would maintain contact with the Syrian opposition, but he and all official staff have left the country. The UK also recalled its ambassador. Russia's foreign minister is scheduled to visit Damascus for talks with the Syrian government on Tuesday.
And those were our international headlines. For more global headlines, for more brief global headlines, we now go to Free Speech Radio News at their website, fsrn.org.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Today is the deadline for states to sign on to President Obama's multi-state mortgage relief agreement that would see banks pony up billions in relief for homeowners who've lost their homes or are about to. California and New York balked at the terms, wanting to be sure that individuals can still sue banks and that investigators can continue probes into what caused the financial meltdown. If the two states do join, the pot of available cash would jump from $19 to $25 billion. In the past 5 years, foreclosures have forced about 4 million families from their homes. Google and Facebook have both censored content from websites in India after a court ordered them to do so. Sharia Niazi has more.
The Delhi High Court said that if 21 internet companies did not remove so-called objectionable content on websites available in India, the government would block the websites like China does. Today, the court further ordered that the firms present a plan for policing their sites within the next 15 days. In recent months, the Indian government has scaled for tighter controls over the internet. Telecommunications Minister Kapil Sibal pointed to offensive religious content that could cause ethnic or intercommunal conflict. India's civil society, and more particularly its very active blogosphere, was outraged by the minister's comments. The court's verdict in support of the government is seen by the net community as a further gagging of free speech. Shura Niazi, FSRN, Bhopal, India.
Mothers in cities around the world held a nurse-in today outside Facebook offices, demanding that the social media giant stop censoring account users who posted pictures of babies at the breast. Facebook responded, saying that while nursing is natural, they will continue to take down pictures that contain a fully exposed breast. In Oakland this morning, demonstrators gathered at the courthouse where 10 people arrested during local Occupy demonstrations appeared. Hundreds of people have been detained by police since the protests began in October. FSRN's George Lavender reports.
Some of those facing charges for participating in Occupy demonstrations appeared in court this morning. All 10 of those in court today were arrested in January when police targeted a gathering of people in downtown Oakland. They were charged with obstructing the sidewalk. Autumn Belknap with the Occupy Legal Committee says the arrests and charges are intended to intimidate people.
It's part of why Occupy Legal is doing the work that we do, is to turn these experiences into empowering ones and to be able to kind of fight for that right to express your discontent.
According to Belknap, another 10 Occupy Oakland demonstrators are still in custody, including one person who has been held since the Oakland general strike in November. Others remain behind bars with bail set at up to $400,000. Further court appearances are scheduled for the coming weeks. Today's courthouse demonstration follows the mass arrest of more than 400 people at Occupy Oakland's move-in day just over a week ago. It was the largest mass arrest in Alameda County since 1982. George Lavender, FSRN, Oakland.
U.S. Park Police were back at Washington, D.C.'s Occupy encampments today, making sure that no one is living in any of the remaining tents. 5 days after their announced deadline, park cops cleared the camps of any overnight camping gear. Some said police confiscated belongings other than sleeping equipment. The Occupy library was not removed. 11 people were arrested. One officer was hit in the face with a brick. In Pittsburgh today, occupiers continued to dismantle their camp after a judge gave them 3 days to vacate. China ordered its airlines not to participate in the European Union's program to limit greenhouse gas emissions from aircraft. From France, FSRN's Liam Moriarty has more.
Since the start of the year, all airlines flying into European airports, even foreign carriers, have to meet increasingly strict emission standards or pay for their excess carbon pollution. The U.S. and other countries have tried unsuccessfully to overturn the EU law in court, and the U.S. House passed a bill that would have outlawed paying the fees, but the Senate killed it. Now, China is the first to refuse to obey what it calls a trade barrier disguised as environmental policy. But EU spokesman Isaac Valero Ladron says Europe is proud of taking the lead in climate protection and plans to stick to its guns.
We're not backing down, and our legislation will apply to these companies operating in Europe.
Valero Ladron notes that airlines can be exempted from the law if they have equivalent carbon reduction measures in their own countries. So far, no other countries have anything close. The impasse is sure to be discussed at a summit meeting in Beijing next week. Also on the agenda, EU officials will try to persuade China to contribute to Europe's financial rescue fund. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
After their failure to agree on the House measure that would have exempted U.S. airlines from the EU law, a broad aviation bill before the Senate later today contains a congressional statement saying that officials should use all means available to be sure that U.S. airlines do not comply with the EU rules. We'll have more on the FAA bill later in the newscast. Egyptian officials identified dozens of people charged with working for organizations that didn't have government approval. 29 foreign nationals and 14 Egyptians are to stand trial. Among them, the son of U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, The staff from the National Democratic Institute, including Chief Julie Hughes, and Patrick Butler with the International Center for Journalists. Egyptian officials say they were doing political work on behalf of foreign interests. The U.S. says that $1.5 billion in foreign aid may not be forthcoming if the situation is not adequately resolved. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
To Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at the website fsrn.org. So, that is our program for today, which is Monday, February 6th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments or get involved with the show or give us an important news tip, please do contact us through our email at news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more independent news, join us on Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Iqbal Ahmed. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Soul Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.